Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 144, Beyond Chrismica. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And today we're continuing our exploration of the American Jewish community in light of the fifth anniversary of the 2013 study by the Pew Research Center called A Portrait of Jewish Americans. That study, like many before and since, found an increasing number of Jews marrying folks who did not grow up Jewish. And having explored that subject somewhat last week with the folks from Honeymoon Israel, we're continuing that exploration today with Professor Samira Mehta. She is Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at Albright College and the author of a book called Beyond Chrismica, A Cultural History of the Christian-Jewish Blended Family from 1965 to 2010. Before we jump into that interview, we also want to make one request of you, our listeners. We are currently conducting a survey of our listeners to try to figure out what our next step should be beyond the podcast. This is not a typical survey. We're not asking you what your favorite episode was or anything like that. We're asking you what you need, what you're looking for in your Jewish life that perhaps this podcast has been helping to fill, and that perhaps this podcast is not enough to fill. So we're asking you to think a little bit with us about what we might do next to be helpful to you. By its nature, a podcast is one way. We don't love it that way, and we're looking to figure out ways to connect with our listeners more broadly, and this is one of those ways. So we're hoping that you'll talk back to us by completing the survey. It's not very long. I think you'll find it really interesting. And as a special reward, anybody who fills out the survey will receive in their email in a few weeks a guide to our first few months of episodes of 2019, so that you'll have a little bit of a sneak preview of what's coming. We're really grateful to anyone who's filled out the survey. We've already gotten well over 100 responses, but this particular survey methodology that we're using hopes for over 250 responses. So we're still looking for a lot of responses. If you're a listener to this podcast and you're enjoying it or not enjoying it so much, please fill out the survey and let us know. The way to do it is go to www.judaismunbound.com/survey, and the rest is pretty self-explanatory. So thank you so much in advance for filling out that survey. And now let's turn our attention to our interview. Samira Mehta, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So let's start by thinking about the title of your book, Beyond Chrismica. So I think it'd be really helpful to get a little bit of a sense of what you were trying to say when you talked about going beyond Chrismica. So tell us a little bit about what the vision of interfaith marriage is that people might have that you were trying to sort of look at and go beyond.
So the term Chrismica came to be from the television show The OC, and it was actually a Time magazine word of the year in 2004. And so that's where I got the term Chrismica, which is sort of inherently a fusion, fairly obviously, I suppose, of the words Christmas and Hanukkah. And it is a reference in some ways to what for easily 20, maybe even 30 years before, had been referred to as the December dilemma. If you're an interfaith couple, or perhaps more to the point, an interfaith family with children, which holiday are you celebrating? Are you celebrating Christmas, or are you celebrating Hanukkah, or are you celebrating both? And that was referred to as the December dilemma. And, you know, almost every newspaper in the country at some point ran some sort of article on the December dilemma. And of course, I'm exaggerating. I haven't looked at every single little newspaper. But the New York Times did, the Washington Post did, and a very good friend of mine's family was featured in the Buffalo local paper, her family's practices. And so, you know, on all sorts of levels of newspaper, you'd see these articles. And Chrismica on the OC, but also in resulting holiday cards and things like that, was framed as 8 days of presents and 1 day of lots of presents. So it's this really late capitalist craze, right? This is not a picture of these holidays that has anything to do with oil that lasts for an inordinately and miraculously long time, or the birth of a savior who will redeem humanity, or peace on earth, goodwill towards men, or, you know, peoplehood, or any of the things that you might, in a religious or quasi-religious sense, associate with either of those holidays. It was just sort of a consumer bacchanal. What I was trying to get at with the idea of Beyond Chrismica both had to do with that holiday observance and the idea that for many, many interfaith families, they're not interested in simply creating some sort of consumer celebration in December, but rather in the deeper meanings that you might associate with those holidays. Or maybe they were more interested in the perseverance of tradition and in peace on earth, goodwill towards men, right? They might be more or less secular, but they're not, they're going for meaning there. They're going for tradition. There are things going on about family and family identity and family observances and practices that may or may not be connected to worldviews as defined by their original religious institutions that may have new meanings inscribed onto them. And so I'm very interested in how the meanings of the practices get shifted by interfaith families. But also, interfaith families are not simply interfaith families in the month of December. They're also interfaith families in July. They're also interfaith families when Passover and Easter roll around. They're interfaith families when Shavuos rolls around. They're interfaith families every single day that they're moving through their lives. And that means very different things to different people. But there's an entire world beyond the December dilemma.
Can you help us concretize this a little bit and talk through, because you have some really amazing examples throughout your book of what this looks like. I love that you mentioned your friend in Buffalo and to show how these newspaper articles about Chrismica could be all over the place, from New York Times all the way on down. I'm wondering, just can you flesh out a little bit of some of the traditional conversations that happen around the December dilemma? Things like Christmas trees. I mean, the cover of your book is a Christmas tree with a Jewish star, with a Magen David, a Star of David on the top, as one example. But can you talk us through a little bit more concretely just what are some of these quote-unquote dilemmas that people have been wrestling with in the past and maybe are wrestling with similarly now or maybe differently?
So let me talk for a minute about the cover, and then I'll get to some of those other dilemmas. So I'm very proud of this cover because often covers are entirely done by a press. And in this case, I actually found the picture. I was going back and forth with my editor, Elaine Meisner, and I had found something that I really liked. And basically she had said, that's going to cost far too much money. And a friend of a friend who is half Episcopalian, half Hindu, married to a Jew, said, we have what we like to refer to as our multi-ethnic holiday foliage. And I have a neighbor with an amazing camera. Would you like me to take a picture of my multi-faith, multi-ethnic holiday foliage? I think she says multi-ethnic and not multi-faith. But, well, if you look at it, and I say this with all of the authority of my own half-Indian, half-Hinduness, I don't see anything that says India to me on this tree. It has a lot of things that represent their household. So there is a Star of David on the top of the tree. There are dreidels hanging off of this tree. But there's also a TARDIS, because they're Doctor Who fans. And the person who owns the tree is actually the curator at the Mutter Museum, which is Philadelphia's Museum of Medical Oddities. And so all over the tree are glitter skulls. And I did not notice that when I sent this picture of the tree to my editor. But the glitter skulls are in part because she's a forensic anthropologist, but she also has her birthday is like November 1st or 2nd. And so here she is, this person who loves bones, with a birthday right by Halloween and the Day of the Dead. And so her friends, while buying birthday cards, will often walk into a CVS and pick up really cheap sort of Halloween Day of the Dead leftovers and tie them into the bows on her presents. And so that's where she's made her ornaments. And so what I really love about this tree is that it's a tree that's deeply reflective of the household that it's in. I think there are also some musical instruments. Her husband is a musician. And so it's a tree that really says, we are a home with a Jew and an Episcopalian, and we are a family that loves Doctor Who and that loves forensic anthropology and that loves music. It's really something that has come out of the home and the family's identities. And I think that that's important because one of the things that people talk about in the December Dilemma or in Concerns About Interfaith Families that are trying to do multiple things is there's this idea that it will be inherently confusing for the children. And I think that in some ways, children live in an extremely complicated world in which there are many things that inform our identities, right? The mom in this family, my friend, who is half Hindu or half Indian with a Hindu father and half Episcopalian or half Cuban with an Episcopalian mother, her mother is half Cuban and half sort of mainline Philadelphia, right? So her mother is the product of a Catholic-Protestant interfaith marriage. And Episcopalianism won because they were living in Philadelphia with the Episcopalian family. But you can see all of those things coming through and all of those identities being moved forward in a variety of ways. And, you know, does it mean what it would mean to be one of those things? No, probably not. But there is this family narrative and family sense of identity that is being carried forward that I don't necessarily think is confusing for their little kid.
So can you give us some other examples as well about the December Dilemma or a vast possibility of other examples of things that people might be surprised about, or, you know, not necessarily a lot of people, but, you know, those particularly in, let's say, positions of power and influence in central Jewish organizations, you know, who have a certain set of assumptions about what this looks like. And it might actually be better and it might actually be worse than they think, you know, in their perspective. But I'd love to sort of give some color to this, some examples of sort of how Jewish Christian families, for example, may do things differently than folks might expect.
Thinking about the example of my friend from Buffalo, in this article in the newspaper from Buffalo in the 1980s, they talk about the fact that her family has chosen to only celebrate Hanukkah. But it really talks about the fact that in that moment, the best practices, as understood by everybody, not just by Jewish organizations, were to pick one religion for the children. The Catholic Church certainly wanted people who intermarried, as they would have said at the time, but people entering interfaith marriages to pick one religion and to have it be Catholicism. Organized Judaism certainly wanted people who entered interfaith marriages to have one religion and to have it be Judaism. Interestingly, the Protestant mainline, and I very intentionally didn't think about evangelical Protestants or Orthodox Jews or more conservative Catholics, because I was interested in people who maybe didn't think that there were big differences between them because they were ecumenically minded people or post-Protestant or secular Jews or lapsed Catholics who then had children and realized that it changed how they felt about their traditions. But the best practices, according to all of those groups, one religion, and the Protestant mainline was fine with the idea that the one religion might be Judaism. So in that article about my friend in Buffalo, you really do see a family doing what conventional best practices said at the moment. It will prevent the children from being confused. And so people, the December Dilemma says, like, pick one and do one. And some people do that and it works really, really well for them. Other people did that and it really bred resentment. And a lot of the resentment came on these gender lines. Who's doing the work? Whose traditions are being honored? And if you're the person who's doing the work and you're the person who's given up their traditions, do you get to go and figure out how to do the other tradition, be it Christianity or Judaism, in a way that is meaningful to you? Or do you have to give up your Christmas tree and not get something that you could love in exchange, right? Because your spouse basically doesn't want Christmas, but also doesn't want to do a big elaborate Seder. right? Do you have to stop going to church, but your husband doesn't want to darken the doorway of a synagogue, and so you just lost any chance of religious community? In my book, I talk about a Jewish Mormon couple, and they talk about how they negotiate the holiday in their household. But he observes that he has both a real allergy to Jesus and a real allergy to Christmas trees. And I think we mean metaphoric allergies. He's not allergic to pine trees. My mother is allergic to pine trees. He's allergic to Christmas trees, right? His wife is Mormon, and she thought about it, and she decided that Jesus is an essential part of the holiday season for her. A Christmas tree is not. And so she thought about what really mattered to her, and she said, you know, Christ matters to me. A Christmas tree does not. And so they put up a creche, a nativity scene, in their house on their mantle, but they don't have a tree. You can imagine, though, somebody who's more of a cultural Christian, somebody who doesn't really believe in Jesus or for whom Jesus isn't super important, who is also in a marriage with a Jew who is allergic to both Jesus and Christmas trees, making the exact opposite decision. I don't really mind about the absence of Jesus, but it makes me really sad to not smell that evergreen smell in my house in December. So you can imagine that negotiation playing out in the exact opposite way. Some families choose to do both, and do both in, say, Unitarian Universalist contexts. And then what they do is they read meanings into the holidays that fit with a UU identity, like freedom fighting with Hanukkah. Hanukkah, you can do this with Pesach, with Passover as well, right? Emphasizing the story of freedom fighting as the key story there. It is important that we fight for our freedom and that we fight for the freedom of other people like us. And wedding that in their Christmas celebration to the idea of peace on earth, goodwill for men. So this is not then an argument about peoplehood. It's not an argument about the dangers of assimilation, which is another spin that you could give to Hanukkah. And it's not the birth of the Savior.
You mentioned how intermarriage can play out along gender lines in some really important ways that we should recognize. And I was thinking of an episode of Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, where there's a male character who's Jewish. He gets married to somebody and she converts for him. And she goes to Israel. She comes back with this gift she put all sorts of thought into. And I forget what the line is, but it is absolutely something like, did she really have to go and get so Jewish? Like, what's the deal? Like, why? Like, she's into this. Like, we want to mention Yiddishisms in conversation. We don't want to, like, talk about Israel.
Nobody wants to talk about Israel. Let's be honest here.
Well, right. Yeah, that's exactly. But so I mean, I was thinking about that, but it opens up an entire other section of your book where you look into the role that intermarriage, interfaith marriage, et cetera, has played in pop culture and how it's sort of shifted and morphed over time. And I really think that that section of your book is just a really huge gift. And so I'd love to hear from you. It's like, how has anything from the December dilemma to just general interfaith marriage been portrayed in pop culture in over the course of, say, the 20th century up till now? And what does that sort of tell us or reflect to us about Christianity, about Judaism, about the relationship between the two?
A way that I would probably think most about the pop culture question is to say, particularly in the 1970s, as the interfaith marriage rate is really skyrocketing, media is very supportive of interfaith marriage. And interfaith marriages that appear on television usually result in relatively happy marriages. I'm going to talk about two examples where they don't, actually from movies, not from TV. But they result in happy marriages because they are a vessel of assimilation. So in movies like The Heartbreak Kid, you've got the Jew assimilating, marrying, leaving his Jewish wife for Sybil Shepherd, who is, you know, this blonde Protestant beauty, all American. She lives in Minnesota. She dates guys with, like, Letterman jackets, and he moves into her world. And you get this sense in the wedding scene that he is moving in that world and he might be a little alienated from it, but it's not portrayed as a bad thing. Because even if he's a little bit of an outsider, this will be the world of their children, right? His kids will be insiders in this American mainstream. And so you see this constant depiction of interfaith marriage as how assimilation happens. And the only times when the marriages are portrayed as unhappy and failing, or the relationships, you get Annie Hall, where of course they never get married, and The Way We Were, where the marriage fails. And in both cases, the failure is about the inability of the Jew to blend in into the WASP world. And the WASP world might be hypocritical, it might be shallow, right? When you watch The Way We Were, I think everybody's on Barbara Streisand's side. She's like passionate. She's in favor of making the world a better place. She is not a hypocrite. She, you know, criticizes hypocritical things about the American government. She's not on the side of this establishment that brushes things under the rug, that doesn't really care, that is anesthetizing itself with its martinis, right? She isn't one of those people, but still the marriage can't survive. She isn't part of that mainstream. She doesn't assimilate, and so the romance fails. And maybe they're better off that way. But if an interfaith marriage isn't an assimilatory marriage, it isn't good. But you can see that as multiculturalism becomes more common, interfaith marriages give more time and attention to non-assimilatory options. So in The Nanny, Fran Fine, she does tone it down, but she never like successfully assimilates. And that's okay. You get the sense that you could have more. Or in 30-something, which is a drama, and it's the first drama to really portray interfaith marriages, you see that maybe they will be Jewish, actually. But in the first episode, where it's really an issue, it's the first season of the show, and they're debating, what are they going to do? And he says, like, I used to love celebrating Christmas with hope, but now I see generations of my ancestors getting up out of their grave to be like, what is this Shonda of a Christmas tree in your living room? And he says to her, what do you believe? Do you believe in heaven? Do you believe in Jesus? Like, what do you believe? And she's like, it's not about what I believe. I want my daughter to have these happy things. And what I love about this episode is that it's not about Jesus for her. It's about looking out a window for Santa. It's about tinsel. It's about warm family memories and hope and peace on earth, goodwill towards men, and all of those things. And so you get the sense that Christianity might be meaningful for reasons that don't have to do with Christian theology. But you see them working it out and finding their way and figuring out how to honor what is important to the both of them. And you see that the interfaith marriage causes them, it doesn't make him less of a Jew to have married a Christian. It actually makes him ask more questions about, why does being Jewish matter to me? He can no longer take it as a default. And in some ways, neither can she, right? Like, she's realizing Jesus might not matter to her, but her heritage and her traditions do.
I think that I have a question about the sort of anxieties that are kind of in play with all this. And I think for me, it's sort of two dimensions looking at that anxiety. One is a question of whether and why there is a particular anxiety about Jewish-Christian interfaith marriage. And, you know, I think a lot of people say the reason why there's a particular anxiety about that is because America is a Christian-dominated country, and the fear is assimilation into the larger dominant culture. And that if we were in a Muslim country, it would be the great fear would be about Jewish Muslim intermarriage or something like that. And I'm wondering about that. Is that the reason for the anxiety, or is it really because of 2000 years of Jewish people, particularly living in Christian areas and having a particular anxiety about Christianity, perhaps also because it sort of came out of Judaism and had rivalries early on? And I'm just sort of wondering if there's any way, you know, to sort of uncover that question. And then the anxiety that I think is related, and it comes up in different ways, is that a lot of folks, including often me, say, you know, what are you so anxious about? We're really talking about an intercultural marriage and not so much an interfaith marriage. You know, both parties, and obviously this isn't always the case, but it's often the case that both parties are really experiencing, whether it's Judaism or Christianity, as more of a culture. And like you were saying earlier, you know, what they're really thinking about is a tree, Santa Claus, you know, not the Jesus stuff on the Christian side. And on the Jewish side, you know, they're also not really talking about Shema and, you know, whatever.
I would say that all religion is culture. All religion is a product of culture. All theology is a product of culture. And that is my stance as a scholar of religious studies, that whether or not theological systems point to greater and unknowable truths out there, the way in which they point and everything about how they structure their pointing is the product of the cultures that gave birth to them. Geographic, historical, constantly changing and constantly evolving, all of those things. But that, so all religion is part of culture, but how and where you define something as religious versus cultural is contextual and often strategic. And what I mean when I say that it's strategic is, to go back to the example of the Christmas tree, there are these advice manuals about how to have interfaith marriages that date to the late 80s, early 90s. And part of what gets argued is that the reason that an interfaith couple should be Jewish, a Christian-Jewish interfaith couple, be the Christian person, Catholic or Protestant, Baptist or Quaker, right, is for a couple of reasons. The first is that the Jew is a minority in a majority Christian culture. And so every time you go outside of your house, Christianity smacks you upside the head. The other argument that is given is that Judaism is a religion and a culture, whereas Christianity is not. Christianity is a set of theological precepts. So that is the argument that is made in these books. Like, so first of all, that means that if neither person is a believer, right, if it's an intercultural marriage and not an interfaith marriage, well, Christianity doesn't have culture, and so Judaism, which is both, should win. And the other argument that gets made is you can't be a good Jew if you're not doing both of these things. Whereas, like, what makes you a Christian is, like, honoring your baptismal covenant, which you honor in your heart. And, like, you don't need a Christmas tree to honor your baptismal covenant. You, in fact, don't need to, like, pray together as a family before dinner. You don't need a minion to do Christian prayer. Now, here's the thing, though. I understand when I depict this argument, people have accused me of creating a straw man, but I swear to God, this is the argument in some of these advice manuals. I'm not making a straw man. And there are some inconsistencies in it right away, right? Why does the Jew need the home as an enclave? They get slapped upside the head by Christianity every time they walk out the door. They're not getting slapped upside the head by people asking them to accept Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. I'm not saying that never happens. I, too, have gotten off of the subway at the Park Street stop in Boston, where people are really dedicated to getting you to accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. Let me tell you. But that's not what's happening when Jews leave their house. They're being confronted with the fact that, like, little kid soccer is on Saturday mornings and not Sundays, and their jingle bells, which says absolutely nothing about Jesus, is playing in the grocery store, right? Like, obviously there's Christian culture. Christian culture is everywhere in the United States. We think that Christians don't have culture in the same way that we don't think of ourselves all of the time as being surrounded by oxygen, right? Like, theoretically, fish don't see water. The other thing that I think is a little bit problematic is, how do you pull apart what makes something cultural or religious? Would it feel like Passover if there wasn't gefilte fish on the table? A lot of the Passover food, right? Like, nothing, Shabbat does not require challah. Shabbat requires bread. We think Shabbat requires challah because we are Eastern European Jews. And I say we, and I mean that I was at a Bend the Arc conference recently in which people were talking about Ashkenazi normativity. So Ashkenazi normativity, right? Like, in the United States, for better or worse, often for worse, what it means to be a Jew is to be an Ashkenazi Jew, right? So we think challah is the bread for Shabbat. There's really no good reason you couldn't have a baguette. There's certainly no good reason you couldn't have pita bread or naan or whatever. But challah is the taste of the holidays. It's the taste of Shabbat for a lot of people, right? Christianity is like that too. Nowhere in Christian law, Catholic or Protestant, does it say that on Christmas Eve, Italians must eat seven fish, right? you can talk about whether in Catholic teachings, you know, during that period of time, you're not supposed to be eating meat. That's fair, but nowhere does it say you have to eat seven fishes. But that is central to what it is to observe Christmas for a lot of Italian Catholics. Do you want to go tell Los Angeles it's not Christmas without tamales? I don't want to tell Los Angeles that. There was an article in Slate that was written by someone who is no longer Catholic. The author self-identifies as Unitarian Universalist, but it's someone who grew up in Scranton. And she talks about how braided together the ethnic parishes were in Scranton, and how for her, being Catholic is so deeply tied to being Polish. It's grandmothers making traditional Polish food in the basement of the church. It's every single parish having a different summer festival at which their local food is served. I think it's just not true to say that Christianity doesn't braid religion and culture together. My best friend grew up in a Presbyterian church in North Carolina that did a Scottish Heritage Sunday every single year. And when we were in college, he missed Scottish Heritage Sunday so much that I learned how to bake Scottish shortbread for him. For him, part of being Presbyterian is bagpipes and kilts and shortbread. And you know, there's an ugly, I've got another friend who is Scottish who writes about the like links between racism and Scottish heritage festivals for Southern Presbyterians. And my friend knows about that and it makes him feel pretty queasy, right? It makes him feel queasy and uncomfortable in all of the ways that our ugly religious heritage might make us feel queasy and uncomfortable. But you know something? He really loves shortbread and it makes him feel like a little kid sitting next to his mom in church.
This is a crucial thing to recognize, because when we think that religion, on the one hand, is this realm where like belief lives and God lives and theology lives and like ideas and thoughts live, and then this thing called culture lives in a different place where food is and where practices are, where like gatherings are and like fun social things are. Like when we think those are separate, we make either an implicit or occasionally explicit distinction that I think causes huge damage, which is that religion is this thing that holds weight for people and that people care deeply about, and that sort of influences core elements of people's being. And culture is this like soft, shallow thing that like, yeah, everybody, like people have their culture, but it's like not so, it's not like it's a religious belief. And when we make that distinction, we get stories like the following, which I'm going to talk about myself, and I'm going to look back in shame at myself, because in my interfaith relationship, I actually don't generally call it an interfaith relationship. In my interrelationship, early in our relationship, we were talking about the Christmas tree question. I mean, we were in college. We didn't even have a house or an apartment that we shared yet, but we were sort of starting to think about what that would look like in the future. And I just assumed, without ever having spoken about it, I assumed that we wouldn't have a Christmas tree. Like, because to me, because my partner Valerie, who I've spoken about on the show in the past, like, she's not doing Christmas for those Jesus reasons that you talked about. And so for me, it's like, if you're not into the Jesus, like, what would matter here? Like, if you don't have that religious piece, what would matter? But the reality is, Valerie had all of the deep, real, I'll even use the word spiritual, cultural connections, because I think spiritual also we mistakenly only put in the religious box. She had a very deep connection to her Christmas tree and to her family's experience of Christmas. We teach people implicitly that culture is something that is sort of sacrificable and negotiable and not that important because it's separate from religion, in quotes. And so I like, that was a Lex rant, and I do plenty of those on this podcast, but it really is one of my deepest held ones, because the message it sends to Jews is that if they're not into the religious, quote unquote, into the theological ideas of Judaism, if they're not digging deep into ideas as their Jewish practice, but are very interested in whether it's Jewish gatherings, whether it's Jewish books, whether it's Jewish foods, whether it's whatever, it tells them that they're doing something less Jewish because it's like not religion-y in their minds. And also, it leads to stories like mine where we dismiss people of other faiths because what they do might not seem to us to be religious. So I guess all that's to say, like, can you help us poke into this question of cultural religion or religious culture a little more, and maybe do it, I mean, we're coming full circle and we're talking about Beyond Chrismica, maybe along the lines of Christmas, because my assertion would be, it's, we hear this truism all the time that, oh, if you don't believe in Jesus, you're not really Christian. And I think that maybe there have been eras and contexts where that is true or close to true. I look out right now and I know a lot of people who like deeply connect to something they might call cultural Christianity or to at least particular elements of the Christian calendar or, like you said, the smell of Christmas trees in a certain time of year. And I think that that idea might need some pushing. So what do we do with all of this religion and culture stuff in the realm of Chrismica?
This is not actually the realm of Chrismica. What came to mind while you were talking is, so while you and I were like shooting the breeze at the beginning of this conversation, I was talking about this debate that I've got going on Facebook about whether or not I should make honey cake for my students. And the reason that I would make honey cake for my students is I'm teaching a class called Dining with God. And it's a first year seminar. And right now we are reading Miriam's Kitchen. And Miriam's Kitchen is a book that I have a lot of affection for and that makes me utterly insane, both at the same time. One of the things that strikes me about it is the main the author, who is also the main character, it's a memoir, Elizabeth Ehrlich, is talking about learning to keep kosher. And she's learning to keep kosher from her mother-in-law, and she's talking about the loss that comes with keeping kosher. Does this really mean she's never going to eat shrimp risotto again? Does it really mean she's never going to sprinkle Parmesan on her vegetable soup that happens to be made with meat stock of some sort? And she talks about how all of this separation, right? Like, and there's a scene in which the babysitter has like totally trashed the kitchen with like pizza and there's dairy stuff everywhere. And she gets home and the leftovers that she wants are soup. And like the microwave is a meat microwave. And so she talks about microwaving the bowl and eating it standing up because there is no non-dairy space in her kitchen. And like that, this is what it is to keep kosher. And it's all about the separation. She talks a lot about how her mother-in-law doesn't have tons of gadgets. She doesn't like have a KitchenAid mixer. She doesn't have like, first of all of these things that you might need two of, right? Because you, I don't know why you'd need a meat KitchenAid mixer, but you might want a part of one. I forget how many sets of dishes she thinks you need because I disagreed with her about it. But like, you know, Passover every day, meat and dairy and fancy meat, and every day meat and dairy and Shabbos meat. So I guess six, right? And so she's going on and on about all of these things that you need to keep kosher. And I'm getting increasingly aggravated as I read it because 95% of the people who I know who keep kosher by being either vegetarian or vegan, right? So they don't have duplicates of everything. And so she's making these assertions about this is what it is to keep kosher. And what she's talking about is this is what it is to keep alive the cultural traditions of pre-war, pre-World War II, European, like Ashkenazi Jewish foodways. And I'm reading about this, and I get so aggravated with her. And I get aggravated with her because she's talking about religious rules. And really, she's wrong. I'm every bit as kosher as she is. Except here's the thing. As a religious studies scholar, I have to say all of those cultural things, the like chopped liver, the act of separating, all of those things are so hugely important to her. They are her motivation. They are where she is finding her spiritual meaning. I don't know that it would be meaningful for her to keep kosher as a vegetarian in the way that I do. And so, as annoyed as I get sitting on my couch reading this, and as much as I want my students to be able to read this and to see that actually if you look at the rules, you don't need to do it the way that she's doing it, I want them to be able to see that, but I don't want to devalue what she's doing. It matters so much to her. right? Why it's meaningful to her is because of this nostalgia, because it's a the nostalgia is a spiritual practice for her. Because to her, it's about keeping alive these traditions that were lost through assimilation and to the Holocaust, and it's got vital meaning because of the Holocaust. That's why it's important. It isn't important to her to be kosher by being vegan. And it gets to what you're saying, right? When I get angry with her, I get angry with her as a Jew myself, who is ticked off because she's presenting this like reified way of doing it that isn't how I do it. But when I'm wearing the Scholar of Religious Studies hat, I don't want them to say, oh, she's wrong, all of that's just culture, because it's her motivation.
I mean, just in the waning moments that we have, I was listening to you on another podcast, and I heard you talk about some work that you were doing over the summer to look at, I think you specifically, Jewish and South Asian or Asian religions, marriages. And I was wondering if you could share with us whether you have found anything important in terms of the distinction between Jews marrying Christians or folks from Christian backgrounds and Jews marrying folks from Asian backgrounds.
So what I would say is that I think that there are a bunch of reasons why Judaism and Christianity have this sticky relationship with each other in terms of interfaith marriage. It's certainly fear of assimilation. It's certainly Christian stuff pushes Jewish buttons in a way that like Buddhist stuff just won't. The concept of Christianity makes Jews uncomfortable, either because of assimilation, right? What does it mean to assimilate into the dominant mainstream? Or because of forced conversion and other historical questions like that, it might be uncomfortable for a Christian to sleep under a cross in a way that it wouldn't be uncomfortable to go to a Buddhist retreat center or a Hindu ashram and sleep under like an Om symbol. The Council of American Jewish Museums actually held a retreat at a conference at a Catholic retreat center, and we all, maybe a Protestant retreat center. Anyway, we all had crosses over our beds and we talked about that. I don't know that we would have all talked about Om symbols, right? And so that tension exists, and it doesn't exist with Hinduism and Buddhism in the same way. And so I think that there's a comfort with those combinations. But I also think it has to do with Western exoticization of Hinduism and Buddhism, right? Think about Jubus. Think about Jews with active yoga practices. This is so exotic. This is so Eastern. There's something about the East and its exoticization that is also in that power dynamic in which, as Westerners, Jews have the upper hand. They're also not taking it seriously, right? Like there's part of it is that it's being exoticized. Part of it is that it's being actually downplayed a little bit.
So, I mean, we've covered so much ground here, and thank you for joining us. But as we close, are there any parting thoughts that you want to leave listeners with, whether it's about Beyond Christmaka, the book, or just more generally about some of the themes that we've brought up today that people can hold with them as they go towards whatever is coming after listening to this podcast?
It's very important for me to say that as a religious studies scholar, I have data and I have interpretation of data. I can tell you about the ways that interfaith families are making meaning out of their lives. I can tell you about the compromises they strike. And I can say to you, these people are not going to come to you and join your religious community if you do not make space for their lives. Some of them will do it on your terms. Others are not going to. Now, what you want to do about that, though, that's not something that I'm going to tell you. That's where this analysis and your values need to come into play. I think that it's reasonable for religious organizations to hold boundary lines and to think about where they want those boundary lines to be. I just think it's important that the boundary lines come from places of what your values are and not what your fears are. And so I would really ask the listeners that you have who are coming from Jewish communal organizations to really think very carefully about their values, not just their Jewish values, but their feminist values maybe, or their egalitarian values, or their ecumenical values, but also their Jewish values. And to really ask, what are those values and how do they play into how I want to interact with this population? What demands I want to make of them to be in my space? And what demands are actually rooted in my fears? Do I really think that people with a robust Shabbos practice and active synagogue engagement and deep dedication to the Hebrew school are trashing it all if they put up a Christmas tree for 3 weeks? That answer to that might be different than, do I think that you should figure out, like, that you should send your kid to Hebrew school on Tuesdays and Thursday afternoons, but you should skip the Sunday morning one so that they're free to go to Christian Sunday school on Sunday morning? But to think about where your values really fall and to try to be rigorous about values instead of fear.
Thank you, Samira Mehta, for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you both for having me.
We want to close out this episode as we always do by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can go to Twitter and find us at Judaism Unbound. Third, you can go to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last plug we like to make is that we greatly appreciate any financial donation you are able to allot for us, and you can do that at judaismunbound.com/donate with either a monthly recurring gift or a one-time donation. So thanks so much for listening, and with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.